This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A calorie is a calorie, we've been told. Eat it, whatever it is, and you'll have to burn it or wear it. But a new study says it's not that simple. American diets are loaded with carbohydrates. And carbs, says the study, make it especially difficult to lose weight and keep it off. And yet they're all over the grocery shelves and food charts this hour on Point. The problem with carbs in our national diet. You can join the conversation. Have you tried it all? High carb, low carb, no carb? What's your experience? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now in the studio is the lead author of the new study just out in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Dr. David Ludwig, professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's director of the Optimal Weight for Life Clinic, that sounds good, and the New Balance Foundation Obesity Prevention Center at Boston's Children's Hospital. An author of also Ending the Food Fight. He's taken a hard look at what's really keeping us fat. Dr. David Ludwig, thank you very much for coming in.
Tom, great to be with you again today.
So we have heard over the years, sort of, it seems like every kind of advice under the sun, you know, Atkins diet, fats and meat and carbs for heart health, go to carbs, not to fats and meat. And here you are saying it matters, not all calories are the same, and that carbs may make it difficult for us to keep weight off, more difficult than other calories in the same number. Why?
Well, by way of background, as you well know, most people can lose weight for a few weeks or months, but very few can keep the weight off over the long term.
So once you've got it, you tend to wear it.
Well, that's the theory of the body weight set point suggests that changes in weight, weight loss in particular, give rise to basic biological responses that lead to weight regain. So we know that when people lose weight, what happens? They get hungrier.
That is when they're working to lose weight, probably dieting.
Maybe. That's right. But the other thing that happens, which is less commonly appreciated but perhaps even more important, is that metabolism slows down, sort of as if you were in the winter in a log cabin with a limited amount of wood and you wanted to make it through the winter without freezing. You'd use less fuel.
So
you
your
keep
body
the temperature
uses
a little bit
fewer
lower
calories. Even if you're exercising or eating less, it's also using less.
That's
so it's
right.
Hard to take it off and keep it off.
Turning down the thermostat and increasing hunger is your body's way of saying, hey, gain weight if you can. And that's a recipe for weight gain and an explanation for why most people ultimately regain weight after several months or a year.
You feel kind of miserably hungry, and even when you try to take it off, keep it off, it doesn't want to stay off.
So a dropping metabolism is going to make you feel cold, tired, hungry, less likely to get off the couch and work out, more likely to run to the refrigerator and regain those calories.
Okay.
But genes are thought to determine this body weight set point, explaining why some people seem to struggle with obesity their entire lives, and other people remain lean almost despite whatever they eat or do. But genes can't be the whole story, as simply shown by the rising average body weight of the American population.
We were not all this obese 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Exactly, and our genes haven't changed. So something in our environment in general, and perhaps our diet in particular, is modifying that body weight set point in the wrong direction. A motivation for our study was to examine how changes in diet composition, independent of calories, might turn down that body weight set point. And if that's the case, it could provide a key to successful long-term weight management.
And this really matters because at this point, we've got something like 65% of Americans overweight, a third classified as obese. That is a big number, and it's got all kinds of consequences.
Exactly. Obesity, we know, is not just a question of appearance. It's one of the leading causes. It is the leading cause of type 2 diabetes, a leading cause of cardiovascular disease and an important contributor to cancer and a host of other crippling chronic diseases. In fact, without attention to the obesity epidemic, life expectancy is predicted, based on work that we did a few years ago, to actually decline in the United States for the first time since the Civil War. And it's not just a question of our longevity and our well-being. Obesity is the prime driver of the rapidly increasing healthcare costs, declining worker productivity.
It goes to our fiscal viability. I mean, it's almost national security.
It is a question of national security. If we could address the obesity epidemic, you know, the Democrats could have a balanced Democrats could have social spending. The Republicans could have a balanced budget, and we could all hopefully get along.
Okay, so you've got our full attention here. It really matters. Take us to the carbs. What's going on with carbohydrates in this whole formula?
So the traditional notion is that a calorie is a calorie, and all you have to do is eat less and exercise more to lose weight. And that has motivated the low-fat diet, which fat being the most calorie-dense nutrient, a gram of fat has twice the calories as a gram of carbohydrate or protein. So it would seem to make sense that if you don't want fat on your body, you shouldn't put fat into your body. Unfortunately, things didn't work out so well. In fact, the obesity epidemic emerged as the proportion of calories from fat in the U.S. diet consistently declined from about 42% of our calories in 1960s when we were all eating steak and butter and cream to now approaching the government recommended 30%. And yet the obesity epidemic increased during that time.
So what's going on maybe here?
So to explore the effects of diet independent of calories, we examined 21 obese young adults, brought their weight down by giving them a low-calorie diet over about 2 months.
Okay. Brought it down significantly by
30 pounds.
Okay. That's a lot.
Yeah, about 10 to 15% of their weight. So that would be a major biological stress. Their metabolism we would expect to decline, hunger increase, and they would be at risk for weight regain
Turn around and go right back
once we left them alone. So we brought their weight down over 2 to 3 months by 30 pounds, stabilized them at this new lower weight, and then studied them for a month at a time on each of three popular diets that reflected a full range of nutrient compositions.
Okay.
So from a conventional low-fat diet at one end of the spectrum, and I'll point out that that was a healthful low-fat diet.
And low-fat tends to mean high carbohydrate because you've got to eat something.
Inherently, that's exactly right. It had 20% fat, 60% carbs, 20% protein. It was full of whole grains, fruits, and vegetables.
So it wasn't just Twinkies.
Low in sugar. So this was a healthful low-fat diet, but the carbs in the diet were, many of them were highly processed, like white bread. Brown bread, even if it's whole grain, is still very processed, so it digests quickly. So the on the other end of the spectrum, we looked at the Atkins-type very low-carb diet that had a whopping 60% of calories as fat.
So a lot of butter and burgers and I don't know what in that diet.
Well, again, we tried to make this a healthy low-carb diet. So again, lots of vegetables, the very few grains were whole, and as many of the fats as possible were on the healthier side, like olive oil.
Okay.
In the middle was what's called the low glycemic index diet. That had
glycemic index.
Yeah, that had normal amounts of fat and protein, but the carbohydrates were less processed, so that they digest more slowly. And they keep blood sugar and insulin levels more stable after the meal. You don't have the same surge and crash. So, for example, steel cutouts, old-fashioned oatmeal.
Instead of instant
oatmeal.
The way
grandmother used to make it, that's a whole grain. And it's much more slowly digesting and keeps blood sugar stable, as you said, compared to instant oats. Or stone ground breads versus highly processed breads that you can, even if they're whole grain, you can put them in your mouth and they seem to melt.
So what did you find about carbs that's got all this new attention focused in their direction here?
So we put our subjects onto each of these three diets for a month at a time and followed their metabolism and their heart disease risk factors. We found that the research subjects burned about 300 calories more a day on the low-carb diet than on the low-fat diet, despite the fact that the same number of calories were going in, 300 more were being burned off on the low-carb diet.
This is a big deal. This means they can stay at a lower weight or even further lose weight.
Well, what is 300 calories today? That's about the number of calories that would be burned off in an hour of moderate intensity physical activity, mm-hmm. in effect without lifting a finger.
Yeah.
And the other comparison was between the low glycemic index diet. The subjects burned off about 150 calories a day more than mm-hmm. on the low-fat diet.
And in the carb-heavy diet?
That was the low-fat diet, which had the worst effects. Mm-hmm. The metabolism plummeted the most on that diet.
What did they burn?
Their metabolic rate dropped by about 400 calories a day compared to where they were before weight loss. So
in other words, the higher the percentage of carbs, the harder it was to keep the weight off because you were burning fewer calories throughout the day.
That's right. And although we think it's not just the number of carbs, but it's also the quality of the carbs. The worst being the highly processed, rapidly digesting carbs mm-hmm. that have invaded our diets. The prototype would be the fat-free Snackwell or the low-fat Twinkie,
mm-hmm.
Which people ate with a vengeance. And the food industry loved marketing these products.
Low fat, great for you.
Because when you remove fat and replace it with refined grains and sugar, it's mm-hmm. actually cheaper to make.
Mm-hmm.
You can call it a health food and market it at a profit.
But if you're trying to keep weight off and you're eating that kind of refined carbohydrate, you're actually driving down your metabolic rate. You're going to have a harder time staying at that lower weight.
Well, that's one of the two main findings of our study, that the low-fat diet had the worst effects on metabolism. The best effects were on the low-carb diet and an intermediate benefit on the low-glycemic. But the other main finding was that heart disease risk factors looked the worst on the low-fat diet. There was also some downsides on the low-carb diet.
Heart disease as well?
And we can come back.
We've got to come back and look at that. Dr. David Ludwig, please stand by. We're talking this about the problem with carbs in our national diet. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the problem with carbs, carbohydrates, in our national diet. And new research that suggests they will make you fat and keep you fat if you don't get the right kind and balance. Dr. David Ludwig is with us. He was lead author of the new study in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association, Effects of Dietary Composition on Energy Expenditure During Weight Loss Maintenance. You can link to the whole study at our website, onpointradio.org. And you were saying that not only did it make it harder to keep the weight off, but it was not good on a heart health spectrum either.
Right.
We thought carbs were at least good for that.
So what we found was the low-fat diet not only had the worst effects on metabolism, causing metabolic rate to drop the most, but it also had adverse effects on most of the components of the so-called metabolic syndrome. That's this new category of heart disease risk factors that seem to be the soil out of which type 2 diabetes and heart disease grows. So specifically,
I thought red meat and fats and inflammatory stuff were the seedbed of
heart. I'll come to the downside to the low-carb diet in a second.
Okay.
The low-fat diet had the worst effects on insulin resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Triglycerides, which are the amount of fat in the bloodstream, mm-hmm. and also the worst effects on good cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, lowering it the most. But
again, when you say low fat, you essentially mean high carbohydrate.
Low fat, 20% fat, 60% carbohydrates, mm-hmm. and with most of those carbs being, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables.
I'm struggling with this because I had this mental image, I think, from all we're bombarded with all this information, but that if you ate a lot of carbs, you might not be, rail thin, but at least you'd be heart healthy.
Well, it turns out that the quality of the carbs are going to be the key. So let's first consider what happened on the Atkins, the very low carbohydrate, high fat diet.
Mm-hmm.
They actually did the best. They did very well in terms of insulin resistance, triglycerides, and good cholesterol.
Okay.
But there seemed to be a catch. That is that we saw a tendency for chronic inflammation to increase.
Not good for heart health.
And the other, perhaps even more concerning change was that the stress hormone cortisol, that's the body's version of the medication cortisone that mm-hmm. you buy in the supermarket, that went up very substantially on the low-carb diet.
Mm-hmm.
And both chronic inflammation and cortisol are key long-term predictors of cardiovascular health and overall mortality. It may be that when you try to push so many calories through a limited metabolic pathway, mm-hmm. it stresses the body. So the intermediate diet that we looked at that had the normal amounts of fat and carbohydrate.
Whatever
but the
normal
carbs,
means in this country these days.
About 40-40. It's okay. 40% and 40%. And it didn't involve restricting either of these mm-hmm. major nutrients. Mm-hmm. But the focus was on keeping those carbs unprocessed, you know, the ones that we'd been consuming mm-hmm. for most of the many thousands of years of our – hundreds of thousands of mm-hmm. years of our evolution. Mm-hmm. That diet seemed to provide the best balance of cardiovascular disease risk and metabolism. So it looks like the low-carb diet may get you there, may get the pounds off the quickest, but has some downsides over the long term. Mm-hmm. And so based on these findings, we would suggest not focusing on severely restricting either fat
or carbohydrate. So not just doing an Atkins eating salami kind of diet.
Not severely restrict mm-hmm. either fat or carbohydrate, mm-hmm. but instead focus on the quality of the fats that we've known and the quality of the carbohydrates, less processed, slower digesting, and certainly cut way down on the refined grain products, white bread, white rice, prepared breakfast cereals, and highly sugared foods.
I want to come back and look at how your recommendation, the sort of spectrum of things you're pushing here compared to what we see on the shelves in our supermarkets. We've got a lot of listeners for you as well, Dr. Ludwig. Let's go to Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up in the 60s, so I'll use that as my reference point. In the 60s, we lived on white rice, white bread, white pasta, but we called it macaroni and spaghetti.
Right.
We ate potatoes by the ton.
Yeah.
In the 60s, nobody cared about any of this stuff. Nobody knew what a carbohydrate was. We just ate food.
Yeah.
And there was no obesity epidemic. I know the biochemistry is the same now as it was 50 years ago. So given the fact that we weren't a nation full of dieters and people worrying about carbohydrates and fat, we just lived our lives. We ate the food. I hear people talk about carbohydrate intake going up in the last 30 or 40 years, which may not be true. I can't imagine because, as I said, we lived on it.
Right, right.
We ate a potato a day, just about.
Yeah.
But even if it did, the thing they always gloss over is the fact that our activity level has decreased in those same 30 years. I'm not talking about exercise. I'm not talking about sports. I'm just talking about simple activity. A kid who comes home from school and sits down and texts and plays his games is not going to be as active as a kid who walks out the door and plays.
Yeah.
And I go through walks through all these neighborhoods around my house in the middle of a beautiful spring day, and I don't see a kid outdoors.
Kevin, you've got a wise and sharp eye, and you raise a lot right there. Let us go to it, and thanks so much for your call. Dr. Ludwig, what about it? I mean, he's right. In the 1960s, boy, you talk about processed. I mean, it was Wonder Bread and macaroni, and there was plenty of the stuff that you're saying stay off of, and yet we didn't have the obesity we have now.
Well, I think your caller is absolutely right to point out that there's many causes of the obesity epidemic, and it would be wrong to target just one factor. And physical activity appears to have declined, although the data on that is a little bit variable as well. But clearly, some people, population averages don't reflect individuals. There's some people who were eating a lot of processed carbs 30 years ago. But overall, the proportion of fat in our diet has declined since the 60s. The proportion of carbohydrates has surged. And those carbohydrates have become more processed than ever before in history. The low-fat snack well is a creation of the 70s. Such carbohydrates, we're always such carbohydrates really didn't exist.
We'll look more at that. Let me get Jason here in Evansville, Indiana. Jason, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think one of the major problems with carbohydrates has to do with kind of geographic location in the United States. For example, I live in southern Indiana. We were named one of the fattest cities in America last year. And as you drive down the main strips in our town, it's only, chain restaurants that offer high-carb, high-fat foods. And, I don't eat a lot of flours or processed carbohydrates. And, there aren't a lot of options when you go out to eat. And I think it has to do a lot with geographic location and what becomes acceptable and what becomes a social norm in your area.
Absolutely. Jason, I appreciate your call from Evansville. I mean, nationally, you've got these foods that you're pointing your finger at all over the place, but I suppose there are areas where they're pushed even harder, where they're more uniformly presented. Certainly, if you look at fast food and you look at sort of big supermarket front of the shelf, you're going to have high processed carbs all over the place, Dr. Ludwig.
Yeah. Well, a little known irony is that if Americans consumed all of the fruits and vegetables that the government is recommending, so at least five a day, we wouldn't have enough agricultural land in cultivation to supply the population. Of course, the food supply is heavily influenced by farm subsidies and special interests that place private profit over public health.
Those farm subsidies make those chain restaurants more profitable.
You know, if we're going to create a national agricultural policy based on dictates from Washington, let's have those dictates be determined by what's best for public health, the nation's obesity prevention efforts, rather than what happens to provide the most profit to food manufacturers over the short term.
Jason, thanks for your call. Dr. Ludwig, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation as well right now from New York. We are joined by somebody with a real eye on what this study means for our dinner plates. Big foodie nutritionist dietitian Ellie Krieger is with us. She's host of the Food Network's Healthy Appetite, author of The Food You Crave and Comfort Food Fix. She's also part of Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign to help fight childhood obesity. Ellie Krieger, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Ludwig.
Hi. So what do you make of these findings, that these carbs are going to make it harder to keep off that weight after you've struggled to lose it? And Lord knows we've got plenty to lose in this country. If you've got the wrong kind of carbs and too much of them, it's going to be hard to keep them off. What do you think, Ellie?
Well, I think, first of all, it's fascinating that what you eat has this incredible, profound effect on your metabolism. So I think this is really groundbreaking in that way and very eye-opening. But in putting it in perspective, and so what does that mean for what we eat? Because I'm always thinking, well, what do I have for lunch? You know, mm-hmm. It really comes down to that.
Yep.
And I think that basically I think it's important to note two things that I think can get, as we report this in the media and as we talk about this with people, I think it's important to note two things. First of all is that both the low carbohydrate and the high carbohydrate had serious health downsides. So from what I understand, Dr. Ludwig, please correct me if I'm mistaken here, is that neither one of those are ideal, but that the middle, the I call it sort of the baby bear principle, is that this center diet that was in the study that's moderate in carbohydrates and looks at the quality of carbohydrates, that's moderate in fat, and I can chime in with adding high, good quality fat, and as well, and that's a more moderate diet overall is
yep.
what is recommended in this study. And, in fact, I think is very consistent, happily, with what the nutrition community has been moving toward more and more rapidly in the certainly in the past 10 years. And I think the My Plate is certainly an improvement from the pyramid in terms of expressing this, although it needs some further kind of enhancement and explanation, but I think the point is that this middle ground moderate diet is where it's at, and it's about eating carbohydrates that are high in quality, so as minimally processed as possible. And I think one important issue is that there is a bit of a difference in the way experts talk about carbs
mm-hmm.
and the way the population at large talks about carbs. So I think it's important to note that carbohydrates in the food in the world of food incorporate fruits, vegetables, dairy products, beans, and as well as what most people call carbs, which are really starches, I guess, which are is more your breads, pastas, corns, things like that. So I think all of that people have to understand that it's really important not to take this as a message to not include important carbohydrate foods like whole fruits and vegetables.
Well, let us look at that for just a minute, and then I want to get very specific on what you might put on that good lunch plate. But, Dr. Ludwig, I'm looking here that, you know, we had the food pyramid. Now it's been changed, and Michelle Obama was instrumental in this, in part to this food plate, and it's divided into different quadrants, nearly. One of them is grains, clearly carbohydrates. The other is vegetables, but as Ellie's pointing out, some of those vegetables are going to be carbs also, right?
Yeah, fruits and vegetables are both predominantly carbohydrate, and that's wonderful that the new My Plate replacing the pyramid suggests covering half the plate with those very healthful, natural
fruits and vegetables.
Fruits and vegetables. The problem, as I see it, with my plate is that the grains don't have a qualifier. Refined grains, now that we're getting trans fat out of the food supply, mm-hmm. are some of the least healthful things we can eat. Clearly raise risk for diabetes and heart disease, and our research and others suggest
when you say gain. Refined grains, you're talking about
white
those
bread,
highly processed, yeah, cakes
white bread,
and
white
breads
rice, and, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of those, and the fat-free snack foods mm-hmm. that you know, anywhere in the supermarket.
Hey, I've gobbled them up.
Yeah, you know, other than the outside aisles.
Yeah.
You know, the prepared. You know, you can go see to the a supermarket could have 50 versions of a highly processed, sugared, refined grain-based breakfast cereal. I mean, they're all versions of sugar and refined starch.
So we want to get away from that.
The problem is that refined grains are among the worst things we can eat, whereas mm-hmm. truly whole grains, minimally processed grains, you know, wheat, berries, barley, rye, quinoa, some of these grains mm-hmm. that we mm-hmm. may not know very much, but these whole kernel oats or steel-cut oats, these are among the most healthful things we could eat.
Ellie, make it very real for us in terms of foods that people know, not these, you know, refined and unrefined, this a little bit high concept here. If you want to put the right stuff, the good quality carbs on your plate and good quality fats for that matter, what's on that plate, Ellie?
And so I do think that fat part of it is really important, and that one of the things that my plate doesn't show either is the fat that may be involved, so that if you're having a piece of whole grain bread that has a lot of, you can actually, when you're having a truly whole grain product, you can really see the grains.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than it looking like kind of mush or even texture on the plate, you're going to see those grains, you're going to be able to chew those grains. It's going to be a chewy experience, which can be very, very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, so if you have this beautiful piece of real whole grain bread and you put peanut butter on it, for example,
yep.
that's an example of having your carbs in a way that's more balanced. You're incorporating a healthy fat. So let's say you have that for breakfast with some fruit. That would be a good movement from, say, a traditional, quote-unquote, healthy, high-carb breakfast.
What if that peanut butter is sweetened?
Well, I would suggest that it shouldn't be. And this is one of the other issues, is that sugar, I think, is a really big message here, that it really as minimal amount of added sugar as possible, added sweeteners as possible. And there's no reason to sweeten your peanut butter. It's just delicious as it is.
Well, so you say, and yet all over the country people are gobbling up, you know, nicely sweetened peanut butter. What about it, Dr.
Well,
Lizabeth?
Mostly the sweetened peanut butters have been created through the low-fat craze. When you take out fat, it's tasteless. So, you know, the industry adds back high-fructose corn syrup to make it palatable. But I'd like to take your audience through a very brief experiment mm-hmm. you can do at home.
Okay.
So grains, starches are nothing more than sugar in a long chain. Sugars are mm-hmm. just single units, glucose or fructose or sucrose. Starch is a long chain. So take a bite of a bagel. Usually there's not added sugar in the recipe. Chew it really well. Mix it with saliva, mm-hmm. and what do you notice? It starts getting sweet to taste.
Yes.
That's sugar popping out of the starch backbone under the weak effects of the digestive enzymes in the mouth.
But presumably this is highly refined, right?
Well, a bagel, you know, mm-hmm. or white bread or white rice applies to all of these refined grain products. So mm-hmm. by the time that bagel hits the powerful digestive enzymes further down in the digestive tract, it literally explodes into glucose, mm-hmm. raising blood sugar quickly,
mm-hmm.
but a few hours later, that blood sugar is crashing down. We get hungry, and according to our research, metabolism may actually be dropping as well.
And therefore, it's going to be harder to keep it off, and we're right back in that trap. Ellie, okay, we've got your whole grain chewy bread and your no sugar peanut butter. We've had breakfast. What's on for lunch?
And we had fruit for breakfast too.
Fruit.
So for lunch, I mean, I think building it around a vegetable base is really great. Like, I personally have been really enjoying these beautiful arugula and fennel salads for lunch, mm-hmm. topped with a good quality tuna or a chicken breast. But the tuna I get in olive oil. And then just a spritz of lemon and maybe some, you know, whole grain rice mixed in there, or maybe not even. So I think the point is that to have a moderate amount of high quality carbohydrates, get most of your carbohydrates from greens, include healthy fats such as olive oil, nuts, And beans are wonderful in there, too. So
Ellie, hold the lunch right there if you'd be good enough. We have to take a short break. Ellie Krieger and Dr. David Ludwig, we're talking about the problem with carbs in our national diet. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the problem with carbs, bad, highly processed carbohydrates in our national diet, and new research that suggests they will make you fat and keep you fat if you don't get the right kind and balance of carbs in your diet. You can join the conversation this hour with Ellie Krieger. She is host of the Healthy Appetite on the Food Network, now airing on the Cooking Channel as well, author of Comfort Food Fix, So Easy, The Food You Crave. She's also worked on Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign to help fight childhood obesity. And with me today in the studio, Dr. David Ludwig. He's lead author of the new study in the new Journal of the American Medical Association called Effects of Dietary Composition on Energy Expenditure, i.e., it matters how you work off the weight, and the food you eat may have a lot to do with that, his study suggests. 800-423-TALK is our number. Let's go to Todd in Omaha, Nebraska. Todd, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having my call, Tom.
Sure.
So the comment I wanted to make is, you know, I'm 44 years old. I have severe heart failure. I'm borderline diabetic, and I'm obese. And even when in the process of trying to eat healthy and lose weight, I would be eating the best possible carbohydrates I could find, as unprocessed and natural as possible. And I would still go through this spiking and crashing of blood sugar. It wasn't until a couple of months ago when I started eating the Paleolithic or hunter-gatherer way, where I cut all those carbohydrates out except for fruits and vegetables, that all of that went away. I mean, not only did my blood work with the cardiologist just become fantastic, but I have no blood sugar spikes and crashes. I have tons of energy, which for a heart patient is really challenging to find, mm-hmm. and I've never physically felt better. So I'm just wondering if for people like me, it seems like the only path to actually attaining a level of health, and how is that going to negatively influence me since I'm halting my march towards diabetes and a heart transplant.
I mean, it sounds generally good. You've gone Paleolithic. Dr. Ludwig, what are you thinking as you hear Todd's story?
Well, first of all, I really want to congratulate you on finding an approach that's working, and it sounds like you've really transformed your eating habits. The fruits and vegetables that you're eating are the best forms of carbohydrate. They're very slow release. You know, you may be able to tolerate some beans or not. Mm-hmm. I can't give medical advice by radio, but I think the key is to emphasize not to eliminate all carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. People who are trying to eliminate all carbohydrates, for example, on an early stage of an Atkins diet, will eat little to no fruit because, you know, the main source of calories from fruit is carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for you, that seems to be working. The key is not to just eliminate fat as we had for 50 years almost, or eliminate carbs entirely. It's to find quality of fats and the quality of carbs that support our metabolism. And from a Paleolithic perspective, humans are omnivorous. We're meant to eat a variety of foods from a variety of sources, so long as they're natural, unprocessed, high in nutrient, and relatively lower in calories.
I guess the point of the Paleolithic is that they didn't have a waving fields of grain.
That's
growing,
right. And grain entered our diet only about 10,000, 12,000 years ago. The human health requirement for grain is zero. That doesn't mean that grains can't be part of a perfectly healthful diet, and that with 7 billion people on the earth, there's no way we're going to feed our population without grains. But let's keep those grains minimally processed and then take advantage of their health benefits.
Jim writes to us online. He says, I've been on a low-carb diet for the past 3 months. There was a considerable and difficult period of withdrawal from the carbs. But after that, wow, the weight is coming off. My indigestion has gone away. I have more energy than ever. My moods don't swing all over the place. I'm no longer constantly hungry, constantly thinking about food. But it's a tough hump to get over. Dr. Ludwig, Ellie Krieger, please stand by for a moment here. I want to bring into our conversation from Ithaca, New York, Anir Tal, postdoctoral research associate in the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University, co-author of the study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, First Foods Most. Anir Tal, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be talking to you.
People talk about how hard it is to get away from bad carbs. Why is it so difficult? What is our... They may be relatively new on Paleolithic timescale to the human population, but man, do we grab onto them hard. Why?
Well, what we find is that in particular circumstances, specifically of short-term food deprivation, people drift towards carbohydrates even more. We think it's because it's just going for more high-energy, dense, more energy-accessible foods help you replenish your supply faster.
And so it makes it, what, we reach for carbs first when we're feeling really hungry? Is that the idea?
Yeah. So in our study, we had participants fast, engage in 18-hour fasts, and then we gave them choices from a buffet, and the percentage of people who chose to start their meals with carbohydrates went considerably up for participants who had been fasting, from about 13% for the non-fasting group to 35% in the fasting group.
So did you come away thinking about how people might resist that urge to grab the, you know, the white roll when you're really hungry or whatever the processed carb is? What's the way to avoid that reaction?
Well, that actually, a lot of the work done previously in the lab under Professor Brian Wansink has dealt with these issues, and there's a few easy factors that we find people can manage to avoid getting into that trap. And some of it has to do with how accessible food is to you. So we find that the accessibility of food in the environment has a high impact on how much you eat of it. People are guided by environmental cues. So you open your fridge and you see a food item, you're much more likely to eat it if it was in the back of the fridge. And these sorts of things are really easy to manage. You can easily put foods you want to avoid in the back of the fridge and you'll eat less of them. Put foods you want to eat more of on the top shelf of the fridge where you can see them. Put foods you want to avoid eating too much of in shelves in your pantry that are less accessible.
Or just don't bring them into the house.
Yeah, that's...
I think that's one of the key...
My solution with my mother. If there's no cake in the house, you don't eat cake.
Right. Anart Tal at Cornell, it's good of you to spend a minute with us, and thank you so much for your the news of your latest study. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tom.
Anart Tal at Cornell. David?
Yeah, with childhood obesity, you know, one of the first rules we teach parents is to protect the home environment. If it doesn't support health, don't bring it into the home. You can say no once to your kids when they ask you for ice cream in the supermarket, or you can try to say no every night when they're nagging you for it if that carton is sitting in the freezer.
But Ellie, here we are, and Anair's research shows, you know, people come in, they're hungry, you show them a buffet, and they go for all the bad stuff. That buffet is kind of the equivalent of most of our supermarkets. They're just loaded with the things that we're hearing today. Thou should not eat.
Yes, and I think that's why you should go to the supermarket with a list and stick to the list. The supermarket is designed to entice you, to make you buy impulsively. It's all about that kind of thing. And so if you go with a list and you stick to it and you keep the things on that list in the healthful range, unprocessed range, then you're going to be on the better track. And frankly, I'll bring my daughter to a farmer's market and say, pick out anything you want. Mm-hmm. And so it can be really fun. I have a 9-year-old, and since she was 3 years old, you know, I had her coming to the farmer's market with me, and that's one place you can feel like, okay, pick something out for dinner. And it's a really fun way to involve children, to educate them about the wonders and deliciousness of healthy food. I think one other point to make that's really key here is that regardless of our balance of carbohydrates and so on, we still need to watch overall calories. And I think that people might think that it may be easier to watch calories if you're not having a very extreme high carbohydrate diet, because you're going to have less hunger overall potentially.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that either way, even if you're on a moderate carbohydrate, moderate fat diet that we're talking about here, you still have to watch your calories, because the difference in what you're going to burn, according to this study, is roughly 150, which is like a little bit more than one tablespoon of oil. So I think putting that in perspective of saying, hey, we really do still have to watch our portions, try to amp up our portions with foods that are not very concentrated in calories, like whole fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do that, then we're going to start to really be on a right track.
A big complex of things coming together here. David Ludwig John writes to us. He says, calories are the problem. People are eating too much food. He goes on to say people are filling themselves with food to satisfy what they are lacking spiritually. I mean, it does get into a really wide
right.
complex
well,
of things.
That's an interesting topic for another hour of discussion, mm-hmm. but I think nothing in our study undermines the notion that calories matter. Of course they do.
Mm-hmm.
The point of our study is that the quality of the calories going in affect the number of the calories coming out.
Make it easy on yourself if you want to try and keep that weight off. Make it as little challenging as
possible.
Well,
that's precisely the point, that by our study was not a behavioral treatment. We're not trying to apply these diets widely to the population right now. We fed all of our participants everything they ate for a seven-month period. But the point is to understand the underlying mechanisms that relate food to our biology. Like Hippocrates said more than 2,000 years ago, let food be your medicine and let medicine be your food. By understanding these principles, we can avoid restricting ourselves unnecessarily. Both our minds and our bodies rebel against excessive restriction. Instead, we can focus our energy on what really matters. And when we do, it's like going from riding a bicycle, engaging into the right gear. Suddenly, instead of pedaling fast and getting nowhere, you plow forward.
But a lot of people, it seems, Ellie, go around in a kind of state of addiction to the very kind of bad carbs that we're talking about here, because it's that old thing, you know, one to the next, the sort of trapeze or whatever you call it.
Well, what's interesting is that when you do start to eat regular meals that are balanced, you become less vulnerable to these sort of addiction, so to speak, that the Cornell professor was talking about in terms of the hunger. When you get yourself into this state of incredible hunger, the first thing you reach for is what your body's going to have quickest access to in terms of energy release, and those are the processed carbs. And so we set ourselves up for that roller coaster by not eating proper meals and snacks throughout the day that are well balanced. And so that is going to be your first line of defense, is to plan your meals ahead and have your refrigerator stocked with foods that are accessible and healthful, and be able to have three meals and one or two well-positioned snacks a day. That's going to keep you on even keel so that you're not vulnerable to these types of impulsive decisions and overeating.
Pat in Grafton, Massachusetts. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
A year ago, I had high blood sugar, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure, and I was weighing in at about 160 pounds, which I'm 5'8",
okay.
and I'm 59 years old. So
okay.
the weight was just slowly going up over the years.
Yep.
Because of those health issues, my daughter offered me a book from her college that was, if you don't take care of your body, where are you going to live? It advocated for a healthy, well-balanced diet. I didn't have to eliminate any particular foods, but it was three meals a day plus three snacks a day. I have lost 15 pounds. My cholesterol is perfect. Blood sugar is not a problem. Now the blood pressure, that may relate more to just age. But it was a very easy diet to go with because it allowed me to eat continuously, you know, periodically throughout the day. And I really didn't have any problem with spikes or anything else. So I think it's...
What was the change you made, Pat? What did you lop off of your former eating habits to get to this more diet of moderation?
Well, actually, I added food.
Oh.
I was more of a binge eater. Like, I'd skip meals and then eat more when I did sit.
Right.
Or when I got home at night because I'm on the road all day.
Mm-hmm.
So I would start eating at 5 o'clock and then continue till I went to bed. So
right.
Now having regular meals through the day allows me to eat less calories but more food.
Hey, Pat, I appreciate your call. Let's talk about the quality of those calories, Dr. Ludwig. Here, Heidi writes to us on Facebook. She says, my husband and I eat carbs and we don't have a problem. Is that because your study doesn't apply to her, or maybe they're eating the high-quality carbs you're talking
people
about?
May differ. You know, the notion that diets may work differently for different people has been around for years. The Eat Right for Your Type, Blood Type book. You know, I'm not certain about the science behind it, but that's the general notion. Some people may be quite tolerant to more carbohydrates. Other people, and we have research looking into this, who are high insulin secretors may mm-hmm. be especially sensitive to both the amount and type of carbohydrate. I think people can generally discover what works for them, but there's never a downside to switching from highly processed to unprocessed carbs, and from switching from predominantly saturated fats to more unsaturated fats.
Let me go to Amanda in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Amanda. You're on the air. Hi, Amanda in Pittsburgh. You're on. Thanks for calling. Oh, Amanda seems to have drifted off a little. Let's get James in Leicester, Vermont. James, you're on.
Thank you. I think that the obesity epidemic in America is traceable to one phenomenon, which is the introduction of synthetic nitrogen and the so-called miracle of American agriculture after World War II. I mean, at that time, in 1940, the average American family had to spend or had to put aside 35% of income for food. Today, thanks to the so-called miracle of American agriculture, that percentage is down to 8 or 9%. The fourfold difference went into our waistlines.
So abundance has not that abundance and low cost has not worked out for us. You think it's the chemicals or just the abundance, James?
Abundance. The most significant. I think the most powerful break on consumption is cost.
Well, except that these things have become cheap.
You know, if that were the case, then you know we would expect poor people to have the lowest obesity rates because for them, the cost of food is relatively much higher than for wealthy people. But in fact, the prevalence of obesity is reversed. Poor
but
people
but
today
have the highest. But is that a quality issue? Isn't it because the food that our policies have made the cheapest is often the least helpful?
I think that's exactly the point. That the foods that we've eaten through hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, fruits, vegetables, beans, things that look like they come from nature, these are the most expensive, whereas the highly processed grains and concentrated sugars are the targets for agricultural subsidies. They can be trademarked. They have unlimited shelf life. The food industry loves to sell them. One more point. The food industry loves the notion that a calorie is a calorie because it justifies marketing of things like the 100-calorie pack of junk food. But our research suggests that the downsides of the 100-calorie pack extend well beyond those 100 calories.
If it's the wrong stuff in that pack. Ellie Krieger, you know food inside and out. Where do you put your processed carbs these days? Is that, I don't know, once a year? Is it once a month, once a week, once a day?
Oh, gosh. You know, rarely, really. I mean, I have a little piece of chocolate every day, but I have dark chocolate. And so I think you really train yourself to not like a lot of highly processed foods. You can really train your taste buds in this direction. And so having a little bit something sweet every day, there's nothing wrong with that. Try to make it whole fruit-based. Try to make it maybe a piece of dark chocolate that doesn't have a lot of added sugar.
Sounds good. We've got to end on that note, but you've got us hungry for the right thing. Ellie Krieger, Dr. David Ludwig, thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.